Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Joshua Kennison. We'll be sharing a little bit of his story of life with a disability. So tell me a little bit about your story.
Well, I am Joshua Kennison. I was born in 1989, no hands, no feet, no tongue, and that is kind of how it all started. And then I went to school and all that normally. I got pulled out of class and stuff. PT and OT. And then that was really my elementary school years. Once I hit middle school and high school, I was never really pulled out of class anymore because I had mastered everything I needed to do on my own. And then, to make a long story short, I graduated high school in 2008. I really didn't want to end my athletic career. And so I went to my prosthetist, and, I told him about that, and he said, well, let me see what I could do. And the next thing I know, he is making me a set of running blades. And I, about a year after that, I started to run in the Paralympics, and that was for about 7 years, and I traveled the world. I was able to hang out with all kinds of other people from around the world that had the same, had the same physical adaptations as me. And it was really awesome. It was really great to go over to Japan, and hang out with them. And I went all over Europe, and then I also was able to travel all over the U.S. and Canada. So it was a really fun time of my life. And now I'm actually moving into my life of a parent. I just had a little girl 2 weeks ago today. So,
congratulations.
I'm actually doing quite well, I think.
So, what's proven to be the biggest support system in your journey of athletics and education?
The biggest support system, I would say, would be my friends and my family. Without them, obviously, I would have no one except people that I just met along the way. And those people have helped, too. But one of the things I forgot to mention was I'm a mentor for kids with limb loss at a camp called Camp No Limits. And, you know, I also consider them my family now, too, because I've been with them now for 10-plus years. So my blood family, my friends I've had, my wife, and then my other family that I consider family, who I help mentor their kids, and, you know, I keep in touch with their parents all year round. So that would be my support system.
So, in all the travels you've had and all the adaptations, is there any success moment for you that stands out?
Oh, yeah, for sure. 2013, I made it to the World Championship for the Paralympics. And I only made it because it was a year after the Paralympic Games, and so some of the top guys, you know, they take a year off or whatever. So I made it just because I was the next guy in line, and I actually won the bronze medal in the 100-meter dash in my classification, which wasn't expected. It wasn't planned on. I mean, when you're trying to win a medal, nothing planned, but I just wasn't in the spotlight to even be considered as a medalist hopeful. So to come back home with a bronze medal in one of the hottest track events in the World Championship was pretty awesome, and that's my favorite moment of my career.
So, if you could send any one message to all the young men and women out there with disabilities who might not know what they're capable of, what might you say?
Usually when I'm talking to my kids that I mentor, and, you know, I also mentor high school kids. I'm a soccer coach as well. So my words are usually just to never give up. And, yeah, pretty much everyone can say that. But when I say never give up, I mean you can't try something once, and, you know, if you fail, then that's it. Never giving up doesn't mean you have to spend hours and hours on that one thing, and, you know, at one time, you're going back to it. For example, I am in college right now. I'm 28, and this is my third time, you know, attending college, and I've never given up on the idea of college, but I just had to put it to the side. And now that I'm older and more mature, I'm ready to tackle the college. And, you know, I think that's what not just people with disabilities need to hear. It's everyone in this world. You know, never give up, keep on trying, you know, whether it's the next month or the next year or years, you know, just never give up and always have an eye on the prize.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. This next segment of our show, we'll hear from Emily McIntyre, from Disability Rights Promotion International. She'll be telling us a little bit about her research into accessible tourism in Nepal. So tell me a little bit about the results of your research in Nepal.
So when I got there, I guess everything, some of the things that I predicted in advance were barriers to accessible tourism, such as lack of infrastructure, issues with policies, lack of implementation by the government, and then just the lack of general awareness and education in the community about how to accommodate for people with disabilities. Some of the other findings that I found were a lot related to the cultural context. The caste system has been abolished in Nepal, but it was still pervasive in society. You could see that there was a lot related to the family that you were born into or your place in a job determined how much say that you had. I saw that there was probably a little bit less power within women in Nepal, and so I took a little bit of a feminist approach to the research as well. And then there was some movement in terms of trying to create accessible tourism experiences. However, it didn't seem on the employment side that a lot of people with disabilities were actually employed within the tourism industry. So that's also one of the big recommendations of my research.
So when you mentioned things like the barriers, how did your research go about combating some of the myths surrounding disability in the area?
Well, it is a small research project. I did a qualitative study, and so I think more so than trying to make a huge change within society, what I'm like in Nepal is I'll give my research back to the participants that were involved, and some of them work, actually most of them are in advocacy positions or they're in highest up management positions within their organizations and their companies. And so I think that is actually the best way of combating any sort of myths or like raising education and awareness is getting people on the ground doing it themselves rather than a researcher coming in and trying to make a difference.
So in your time conducting the research, was there any success that you'd like to highlight?
I would say one of the biggest successes is just sort of the network and the openness of the community there. So I think within some of the models in studies that I've worked in the past are more people keep information to themselves within organizations, whereas in Nepal there's like a very strong network within the private sector, within organizations for people with disabilities that are all working together. And so I think that you can really utilize that opportunity. And so in my recommendations, I've also created suggestions of like non-traditional ways that people can work together. And I think that that's going to be one of the unique ways. For example, I'll give a specific example related to the tourism industry. I know for personal support workers or caregivers to come to a different country with a tourist, it could be quite expensive, and that's something in Nepal that they're offering, and then you could hire locals as well, and it can be at much more affordable rates. So I think that's one way that accessible tourism could be promoted there for sure.
So what are the next steps in your work?
My next steps will be I have to finish the final draft, and then after that I would like to publish my work, and I would like to give it back to everybody that's involved, and I've made it clear that I'm willing to maintain an ongoing relationship, so if they have questions about my research or if there's ways that I can just be a resource for them too with some of the things that they might want to implement from it, then I'm totally good to be there for them as well.
So if you could send any one message about the need to look at accessibility as a universal concept instead of just what's here at home, what would you say?
I would say, I mean, obviously, like I think one of the things that I was grappling with in my research was trying to determine is like the desire for accessible tourism enough when you're faced with all of these barriers within like physical barriers, but also attitudinal barriers and so on. And so I think, though, that most people, if they could go to Nepal with the understanding that it's not going to be a perfect experience, that it might be messy, that they're going to be some of the pioneers of people going and doing this accessible tourism experience, and just understanding the unperfectness of that, then I think that it's a great destination to go to, because there's the willingness of people there to make an experience for them. I just, like, there has to be that understanding that there are going to be some barriers along the tour and that things aren't always going to go seamlessly. So it takes a certain kind of person, I think, to want to go to Nepal for adventure tourism.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Peer Support Center is here to remind students that they are not alone. Most students are experiencing university life for the first time, but can also bring levels of anxiety, financial strain, and loneliness. Professional help is available to all students 24 hours a day. They are also available on a drop-in basis from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. The center is located in room 208 of the Koss Student Center, and for more information, please call 519-253-3000, extension 4551, or email psc@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Paralympic athlete Joshua Kennison and Disability Rights Promotion International researcher Emily McIntyre. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Catherine Underwood from Ryerson University. She'll be telling us a little bit about a project related to disabilities in early childhood. So tell me a little bit about your latest project concerning early childhood and disability.
So this project's called the Inclusive Early Childhood Service System Project, and it's a longitudinal study, meaning we interview people over a period of time, and this study is taking place in five communities in the province of Ontario, and we've been talking to families about their experiences of interacting with a whole range of services, starting from the age of two and as their children age into school.
So, what are some of the most common barriers to service?
Well, we aren't specifically looking at barriers to service. What we're interested in is how the interactions that families have with institutions leads to the ways in which they think about disability in early childhood. So one of the things that we found is that many of the services require a diagnosis or a designation in order for families to access those services. So we know that when that is a requirement for service, then families spend a lot of time trying to get that diagnosis. And of course, the experience of getting a diagnosis means many things to different people. But one of the things that it can do is to reinforce a medicalized way or a pathological way of thinking about disability in childhood rather than a more holistic way of thinking about childhood. And we also find that that leads to service providers such as early childhood educators or school teachers feeling that they can only support children when those children have a diagnosis, that until there's a diagnosis, they won't know how to take care of those children. And we don't think that's actually true. We think that there's a lot of things you can do to support children, whether they have a diagnosis or not.
Well, one of the key things in that is just because a child has a diagnosis, it doesn't mean every educator can understand every symptom related to it. So,
of course, and nor should they have to, because sometimes we know that for all children, there's many things about a child that a teacher or an early childhood educator won't know, but they can still serve that child very well, even without having all of the information.
So what was the inspiration behind this project?
It actually came from a previous study. This project was designed in collaboration with a number of partners. So the project was first supported by Wellington County and in addition to Ryerson University, where I work, also the District of Temiskaming in Northern Ontario, the City of Toronto, and the City of Hamilton. And those communities came together and based on a previous study where we had heard from families that there was a lack of information about access to what they called special needs services, we wanted to explore that further. So it was together that we designed this study and thought about the kinds of questions we wanted to ask. And we think this study is a little bit different from other studies because we're not only interested in developmental outcomes for children, we're actually interested in studying how institutional responses to disability are constructed in early childhood from the viewpoint of family.
So, if you could send any one message about the need for a project like this and the awareness it can potentially bring, what would you say?
I would say that two things. One, we need to you said one message, but now I'm going to give you two.
That's all right.
I would say one of the messages is that it's really important to know just how much is being asked of families. They are doing an awful lot of the work of this early years service system. So sometimes we think that the government, we know that the government spends money on these programs and the government's policies are all about how they design these programs, thinking about their budgets and their staffing complements and how much space they need. But often it goes unrecognized just how much of the work is being done by families. So that's one thing that I think needs to be much better understood. And then the second thing is just how this system is creating, is constructing the identity of young children as disabled, and that in the adult disability community, we actually have some ways of thinking about disability that are very positive related to the culture of disability, the collective impact of disabled people, but we have almost no ways our society thinks about disability in positive ways for very young children, and I think we need to really work harder at that.
So what are the next steps in the project?
This project has been a 3-year, we've done 3 years of data collection. It's a 5-year project, but we're in our last year of the project. We have recently submitted an application to get additional funding to continue with the project so that we can follow these same families up until their children are in grade 3, and also to do a new recruitment so that we can learn from more families and also expand to other provinces and territories. So we're looking to expand to Manitoba, British Columbia, and the Northwest Territories.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Disabilities and early childhood ed. In my opinion, this is one of the hot-button issues. It has to be constructed in a way that a young child can actually understand and reason out. But if they come to the conclusion that a person with a disability is just a person, that this is normal, that this is a part of life, they'll be far better prepared for that day when they run into someone who has something different than themselves. I take a strong stance on this because there are a lot of myths and there is a lot of prejudice out there concerning it, because the simple fact is sheltering these kids from the idea that disability exists and people are diverse, you're not doing them any favors, folks. You're only saying to them that you can accept this person because he looks, talks, and moves like you, but you can't accept that one because maybe there's something a little different about it. These barriers have to come down. Simple as that. I mean, a family experience with disability, it's going to be different every single time, you know. Fact is, parents facing a child's illness for the first time, they're going to struggle and they're going to have all those questions. Where do I go for support? Who can I turn to? Who can I trust? What is the latest information? Yeah. All those questions, they run through every parent, every family's mind. But also, we have this tendency, says, play out worst case scenario. Build it up to be frightening. Build it up to seem hopeless in our minds. We don't do it consciously, but the fact is, for any condition, any disability, no matter what the statistics say, there's someone who's beaten the odds. Maybe they haven't recovered completely, but there's always somebody who's found a better quality of life, steps they can take to improve the situation. And that is what we must all look for at all times. Hope. That hope begins with the understanding disability is part of life. It's not a life sentence. It's one factor of who a person is. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love your stories and your thoughts, folks. For accessible tourism today, fantastic interview. Fact is, this is something we must always bear in mind as well, that what's good for us here at home, the infrastructure, the accessibility, the seeds of accessibility, they should be widely sown. For the fact is, we are a global community. People with disabilities, they're going to want to venture outside what they know, where they've spent their whole lives living. They're going to want to travel, see a new place, have an adventure. They're like anyone else in that sense. And these communities need to know what it really means. By creating accessible infrastructure, we're not just doing it for the incoming tourists. We're doing it for those living in these areas who don't necessarily have anything in place. But the fact is, groups like DRPI are coming in and they're challenging the myths and the stereotypes surrounding disability. Where once it may have been viewed as a hopeless curse, now it is viewed as something we can work with, something we can build with. That these people have rights, hopes, dreams, talents, all their own. And it is not our place as a people to underestimate any of them. Instead, it is our place to ask the question, is everything that can be done for you being done for you? Truth is, people with disabilities, they have the right, from the day they're born onward, to learn and grow, explore their own potential, and explore this world of ours. Whether they want to be a bronze medalist, defying the odds, defying what we think is possible, or they just want to go see Nepal, the principle's the same thing. If a person with a disability is born into your family, you cannot say to them, we love you, we value you, we're going to deny you your heart's dream. That's nobody's place, that's nobody's right. But going forward, I see a lot of hope in the world that we're even recognizing that we can think beyond ourselves shows a real progress, real respect for our fellow human beings. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.